Hi, I'm Neil Denny, and you're listening to the second Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. Right now, I'm in Pasadena, California, and I've just returned from JPL, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, from where NASA runs its non-human space program. It's a really exciting time to visit. I arrived just in the middle of mission readiness testing for the landing of the Mars Curiosity rover. This is already well on its way to the Red Planet, and is due to land in Mars's Gale Crater region on the 6th of August this year. While I was at JPL, I got to see Mission Control, where you could see screens streaming data in real time from 23 active spacecraft, such as Cassini, Juno, Grail, Voyager, and the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. I saw versions of the Curiosity rover being tested, both in labs and out on the Mars yard, basically an empty lot, landscaped to look like the surface of Mars. And I saw labs where scientists attempt to recreate the conditions on the moons of the outer planets here on Earth. And I got to see all of this thanks to JPL scientist Kevin Hand, who you're about to listen to me talk to. Kevin Hand is Deputy Chief Scientist of Solar System Exploration at JPL. He's an astrobiologist and a planetary scientist by trade, most concerned with studying the Jovian moon Europa. This study has led him both to Antarctica and to deep-sea hydrothermal vents, the second of which he did in the company of the film director James Cameron. So I'm sat here with Kevin Hand. Kevin, you just gave me a fantastic tour of the JPL facility, but we're going to talk about your work for a little while now, so thanks for speaking to Little Atoms today.
Hey, my pleasure, Neil.
You're an astrobiologist and a planetary scientist. Talk a little bit about your background and how you actually got interested in those things and how you got to be here now.
Well, I was born and raised in a small town in Vermont. You ever hear of Vermont?
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful little part of the U.S.
Lots of cows.
Lots of cows, great ice cream, lots of cheese, and good beer. And so I was raised in a really small town of a few thousand people, Manchester, Vermont. And just had an amazing childhood of growing up under the night sky, seeing lots of stars, camping out. And that was the real sort of tether. I think given that experience, you can't help as a young kid but look up and ask the big questions of where are we, how do we get here, and where did we all come from, and is there anybody else out there? Along with that, I had great friends that explored the woods with me and parents that just sort of let us roam, great science teacher in junior high, and Carl Sagan. The Cosmos series and the books were critical in that, in my sort of intellectual development. So yeah, I went on to study physics and astronomy from there, and then did a master's in robotics, and then did a PhD that centered on Europa, which we'll talk about in a bit. And after I finished my PhD, I got hired as a scientist out here at JPL, and my current position is Deputy Chief Scientist for Solar System Exploration, which basically means I do fundamental research in our lab here and numerical modeling. I do instrument development for upcoming missions. I do mission formulation, and there's a lot of work that goes behind a mission before it ever reaches the launch pad. And so we're working hard to try and get a mission to Europa off the ground. And then I also have a component of my work that involves field work, understanding places here on Earth, extreme environments on Earth, ices and snow here on Earth. And so it's quite a diverse array of stuff. It keeps me busy. I love it. And so here we are now.
Your main focus is on Europa, the moon of Jupiter. So let's talk first of all about why Europa. What's special about Europa?
So my obsession with the search for life elsewhere, and this goes back to when I was a kid, I feel like I'm still asking the same basic question. Are we alone? Is there life beyond Earth? I'm still asking the same basic question I was asking when I was 10, but now I'm doing it with a lot more math and a lot more technology. One of the key aspects of finding life elsewhere is our ability to compare it to life as we know it, to compare it to the tree of life here on Earth, and see whether or not that life represents a second origin of life in our solar system or beyond. And Europa has a global liquid water ocean today. And if we've learned anything about life on Earth, it's that where you find the liquid water, you find life. And so Europa, in my opinion, is the prime place to go to search for living life, extant life, as we say. Mars, I love Mars, and I'm somewhat involved with some things on Mars, but most of our astrobiological research on Mars is focused on evidence of life in the past as recorded in the rock record. And that's revolutionary. If we go to Mars as the Curiosity rover, which was built and is being managed by JPL, if the Curiosity rover lands and finds fossils at Gale Crater, you know, or even stromatolites or some evidence in the rock record of past life, that's absolutely phenomenal. But fossils sort of make it hard to connect back to fundamental biochemistry. What I want to know is, all life on Earth is based on the same fundamental biochemistry, the biochemistry of DNA, RNA, and proteins, and even ATP for the most part. Whether you're a microbe at a hydrothermal vent or you're a computer programmer at a software company, we all function on that same basic biochemistry. So I'm curious, is there another game in town? Is there another way to get the business of life done? And I think in order to answer that question, we need to go to places that could harbor living life. And so Europa, Enceladus, these ocean worlds of the outer solar system, where there is liquid water today and where we think there's been liquid water for much of the history of the solar system, those are the places that entice me the most when it comes to answering that question.
There's a European Space Agency mission that's just been announced that's going to go out to Ganymede and Europa, and there's nothing actually at the moment on the books here at JPL particularly, but let's talk about a hypothetical mission. What would we do? What would be the best way to get out there? What do you think, to go out and actually look for life? How would we go about it?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a complicated question to answer. Life, we don't even have a good definition for life. And so how do you look for something when you don't have the parameters fully defined? And so looking for life and having a mission that is a life detection mission is kind of a non-starter to some extent. What is useful and what you can develop hypotheses around, however, is the concept of habitability. And so with a mission to Europa and a mission to Ganymede, as is being advanced by the European Space Agency, those missions and the Curiosity rover all sort of use the language of assessing habitability, both past and present. And that's because you can build instruments to measure things like, in the case of Europa, we could measure the salt concentration. In an ideal case, we could measure salt and pH and temperature and all these parameters to see how they map onto our understanding of what it takes for an environment to be habitable on Earth. So that's hypothesis-driven science. But on top of that, you want to make sure your payload, your instruments, have the capability to do discovery-driven science. And I would classify life detection as discovery-driven. You've got a microscope, you've got a mass spectrometer on board, so that, you know, if there are little things swimming around in the water, you'll see them. But if there aren't little things swimming around, you'll also get very useful science done by looking at the ice grains or the non-water components. So it's a tricky, this issue of assessing habitability and doing hypothesis-driven science where you can actually build instruments and predict measurements or make measurements based on predictions versus obviously the holy grail of actually detecting life. That's one of the challenges that we face in the astrobiology community, and that's one of the challenges that we try and address on a technological scale here at JPL. So it's not easy, but that balance of hypothesis-driven and discovery-driven science is part of the answer.
When we talk about ice planets, and it's easy to picture Hoth or something, you know, with actual Antarctica in space. But what is the actual surface conditions like on a planet like Europa?
Yeah, nobody's going to want to go to the surface of Europa. I would love to sit in a spacecraft out maybe in orbit around Callisto, where the radiation isn't as bad, look in towards Jupiter, send a little melt probe off to Europa that melts down through the ice. And the ice on Europa, we think it's a few to maybe as much as 15 or so kilometers in thickness. To give you a frame of reference, the Antarctic ice sheet is about 4 kilometers in thickness, 4 kilometers above Lake Vostok, for instance. The ocean on Europa is, on average, we estimate to be about 100 kilometers in depth, and that's a global ocean. For reference, the deepest point in Earth's ocean is 11 kilometers, and on average, our ocean is 4 kilometers in depth. So you do the math, it turns out that Europa has about twice, possibly three times, the volume of all the liquid water on Earth. That's a tremendous volume of liquid water. So nobody's going to go and set up shop on the surface. It's fun to think about, and you can come up with ways to make shelters and shielding for the radiation that's bombarding Europa. But in general, there's no atmosphere. It's 1/7 the gravity. You've got about 125 milliwatts per square meter of particle irradiation. It's 100 Kelvin. There's plenty of water. That's the upshot. You got water, and there's actually oxygen trapped in the ice. That radiation from Jupiter's magnetic field splits apart some of the water and creates oxygen molecules that get trapped in the ice. So we actually know that the ice of Europa is rich in oxygen. But yeah, those are the only two positive things, is that water and oxygen is there.
There are various components that you need that are found on Earth to make life, obviously water being the key one, or sort of organic chemistry. Where do you expect to find this on Europa? How would those processes enact?
The kind of keystones of habitability are, at least based on life as we know it, habitable environments here on Earth. Life needs liquid water. Life needs access to the essential elements, premier of which are your carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur. We need a smattering of metals. And then the third is that life needs some form of energy to get the business of life done, mm-hmm. to do the repair and growth and reproduction and all those things. So water, elements, and energy are kind of the keystones. And part of what's fascinating about Europa and Enceladus in many aspects also is that not only does Europa have the liquid water, but we think that Europa's ocean is underlain by a rocky silicate seafloor. Mm-hmm. Rocks, the same way we know and love rocks here on Earth. And so the seafloor of Europa may also have things like hydrothermal vents that supply some of the chemistry that life loves. We think that the radiation environment on the surface, if some of those radiation-produced compounds that are produced on the surface are mixed into the ocean through cracking and fracturing and stuff, that radiation chemistry could also help maintain an ocean that not only is liquid water, but also has the elements and has the chemistry. We call this sort of the redox chemistry, your reductants and oxidants, kind of the negative and positive terminals of the biochemical battery. We think that the seafloor and the radiation chemistry might be the sources for that chemistry to power life. Whether or not the surface ice of Europa actually harbors a record of any subsurface inhabitants is a whole nother story. But the surface of Europa, with its paucity of craters, does seem to be quite young. A few tens of millions of years in age. The upper end is maybe 100 million years. And that sounds like a long time to you and me.
But not in comparison to the Earth.
Right. On biological timescales, on human timescales, that's very long. But geologically, even 100 million years is instantaneous. And so the fact that Europa's ice is so young really, we think, harkens to some means for cycling the ice into the ocean and the ocean into the ice. And so you look at Europa and you see these pictures of the white, which is the ice, but then you see this dark material, some reddish-brown material. We think some of that is salt, some of it is sulfuric acid, but at this point we just don't know. Is there organic chemistry within that dark material? Are there little dead relics of microbes from below that are contained within that dark material? We just don't know. The Galileo spacecraft, which made flybys of Europa in the late 90s and the early part of this millennia, provided us with incredible images and spectra and lots of other data sets that have taught us much of what we know about Europa. But it just cracked open the door and let us see how spectacular this world is, and now we're dying to get back there.
We can send probes out there. Obviously, we can't go there ourselves just yet, and I guess there's only a certain amount of stuff we can do via the probes. So a lot of research is done here on Earth, in places on Earth that are somehow analogous to what we imagine, not just Europa, but other planets, Mars, for instance. And the obvious one is Antarctica, and you spent time in Antarctica, so let's talk about what was that like?
In one word, spectacular. We were down there doing research on what are called the cryptoendolithic microbial communities that These are microbes, actually, they're sort of partnerships of microbes that live in the pore spaces between the sandstone grains of a particular region of, mm-hmm. Of the geological structures of the mountains, the stratigraphy there. And we were studying these microbes with an instrument that we've built here in the lab. This is an instrument that we hope to someday fly to Mars, someday fly to Europa, someday fly to Ganymede or Enceladus. And that work that we were doing, on the science side, we were better understanding these microbial communities. And it's important to do the science in situ because, especially in a place like Antarctica, we're out there in the mountains, and traditionally what a scientist has to do is go there, pick up a rock, put it in a bag, and bring it back to McMurdo on a helicopter, and then put it on a boat, and then the boat takes a few months to get back to California or whatever. By that time, the rock has warmed up, it's gotten all humid, there's lots of water, mm-hmm. and the microbes in the rock are saying, hey, conditions are changing. Some of the microbes that were doing well before are now dead, and some of the microbes that were barely surviving in Antarctica are now thriving. So, especially when it comes to biology, you change the environmental conditions and you change what you're observing. And so our instrument was very good at connecting the biological chemistry to the geochemistry while we were down there in Antarctica. So that was sort of the science side. On the technology side, this was an instrument, or is an instrument, that when you see the Mars rovers reach out and put its robotic arm up against a rock to do some science, or when you see data coming back from the Cassini spacecraft orbiting Saturn and flying by worlds like Titan and Enceladus, the instruments that are making those measurements have a tremendously long history of evolution. They represent kind of the Homo sapien of instruments, right? They're at the far end in terms of the modern reach. Not to pat ourselves on the back too much, but the sort of version of the instrument that we brought down to Antarctica is kind of the Australopithecus. We hope to someday evolve the instrument all the way along to a great form, but that was it in the early stages down there in Antarctica. We've come a long way since then, and we'll hopefully get better prepared for the environment of Europa and these other worlds.
Well, another place that's on Earth that it's not that long that we actually discovered that there was forms of life down there, and is something that's more analogous to Europa perhaps, is the sort of deep sea vents, hydrothermal vents. So you've been involved in studying those. In fact, you were involved with one of James Cameron's expeditions and were a sort of scientist on one of his films studying the bottom of the ocean. So let's talk about that. First of all, let's talk about what life we can expect to find at hydrothermal vents, and then we can talk about what it was like working with James Cameron.
Yeah, well, the hydrothermal vents are just an absolutely stunning discovery. Back in 1977, out at the Galapagos, geologists were studying these thermal anomalies, and lo and behold, these hot springs at the bottom of the ocean, these hydrothermal vents, were not just geologically active, but they were biologically active. And so that was astonishing. These ecosystems where the base of the food chain is chemosynthesis. Mm-hmm. Microbes and other small creatures surviving off the chemistry of the vents, not off of photosynthesis for primary production. And then the larger creatures eat the smaller creatures, and you've got your food chain. As far as what that implies for worlds like Europa, first of all, who knows, right? If life on Europa is not based on DNA, RNA, proteins, etc., all bets are off. But even if life on Europa is based on the same fundamental biochemistry, then we get to do all sorts of amazing comparisons about contingency versus convergence. Imagine if we go to Europa and there are creatures with eyes and tube worms that have got some of the similar form factor, but have come about in a completely different environment. To some extent, it's not that surprising. Mm-hmm. Right? Evolution tells us that life is, in some ways, a reflection of the environment in which it exists. And so on Europa, the temperature of the water, it's comparable to what we find at the depths of our ocean. The pressure, somewhat comparable to the deepest depths in Challenger Deep here on Earth. And the reason for that is because, of course, while Europa's ocean is much deeper, the gravity on Europa is about 1/7 that of the Earth. And so the trade ends up being that the 110 megapascals of Challenger Deep here on Earth is comparable to about 80 kilometers depth on Europa. So again, pressure, not that bad. Nothing life on Earth can't handle. Temperature, not that bad. Salinity, yeah, it's probably saltier than Earth's ocean, but we don't know yet. pH, yeah, life on Earth seems to survive in a host of different pH environments. So on the one hand, we might have life completely different. On the other hand, we might find that there are similar solutions, whether you're going to different environments on Earth or similar environments on different planets.
Okay, so now let's spend some time talking about what it was like working with James Cameron.
Spectacular. I got to go down to the bottom of the ocean about 9 times. I got to see hydrothermal vents along the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, the East Pacific Rise, and I was with him on his most recent expedition out to Challenger Deep. Only Jim got to go down in that in the new vessel. But to actually see these environments, the hydrothermal vents, with my own eyes, and to experience the depths of our ocean. As much as I love robotic exploration for getting things done, I am a human explorer at heart and love to explore regions on Earth. And so to be down there, I was in the Russian submersibles, the Mir submersibles. And those can house 3 people at once. And we typically had 1 scientist, 1 submersible pilot, and then 1 person that was working on the IMAX film. And sometimes that was Jim, sometimes that was other camera operators. And so to be down there, to go down to the bottom of the ocean, and then just cruise along the bottom in search of the hydrothermal vents. Because navigating on the bottom of the ocean is pretty difficult. You can't really pinpoint things easily. And while I loved seeing the hydrothermal vents directly, what I also found fascinating and just jaw-dropping was doing the tic-tac back and forth as we scanned the bottom of the ocean looking for the vents. And what you learn is that one of the best ways to find the vents is to look for life. You're cruising across the bottom of the ocean and you see nothing, no life. You just see rocks and maybe some sediments. But then maybe you'll see a little Zwarcid fish go across your portal. Or you'll see a little crab or something. And you just follow the gradient of biology, and eventually it will lead you to the castle that is a hydrothermal vent covered with tube worms and mussels and all sorts of things. So that was just the experience of a lifetime to be a part of that IMAX movie.
So tell us a little bit about the recent Challenger Deep expedition, and I wasn't aware that you were on that one as well. So I watched that unfold on Twitter at home, and it was an incredibly exciting thing to be watching, like real groundbreaking exploration going on there in real time.
So were you getting Paul Allen's Twitter feed on that? Yes. So that was just astonishing. We were out there. We had 2 boats, a science boat called the Barracuda and the engineering boat called the Mermaid Sapphire. And so the submersible that Jim and the team had built was on Mermaid Sapphire, and we had most of our science operations on Barracuda. But then due to time constraints and Jim had to get off to the UK, to London, to go visit you guys and do the Titanic premiere. And so he was up against a really hard deadline and various challenges with wet weather, and some of the engineering side of the submersible pushed us right up to that final Monday, I think it was, where he had to either do the dive or he was going to have to leave, go to London, come back, and then do the dive after the Titanic premiere. So Monday morning comes, and the only way that this whole thing was going to be possible was if Jim could get out of the middle of the ocean in time to get to Guam to catch a charter flight to the UK. And the boats that we had weren't fast enough. So we get out to the site where Challenger Deep is in the middle of the ocean, and I don't know how this all came together, but, you know, if powerful people know powerful people. Jim got on the phone to Paul Allen. Next thing we know, Paul Allen's out there in his massive yacht, which has got a helicopter and a submersible and all these other things. And so there we are out in the middle of the ocean. Jim goes down in the sub early in the morning on Monday, gets down to the bottom. Everything works great except for the robotic arm. There were difficulties there, but the most important stuff, the life support, the communications, all that worked brilliantly. Jim comes back up to the surface, does some interviews for the documentary and everything, and then goes over to Paul Allen's boat. Meanwhile, Paul Allen was up in the helicopter, twittering, tweeting, whatever it is, in real time. And so it was quite a spectacle of these boats out there, and a lot of excitement, but a lot of trepidation also. You know, this, for me, part of my background is engineering. I did a master's in robotics before doing my PhD in science. And part of what we do here at JPL is build things that work really well. The Mars Exploration Rover's still going, right? At least Opportunity's still going. Guaranteed to last 90 days. Here we are 8-some-odd years later, and the thing's still trucking. But to build something with that kind of quality and that kind of redundancy, et cetera, costs a lot of money. It takes a lot of time. You've seen some of the testing being done for MSL, the Curiosity Rover, here today. All of those different tests are a lead-up and part of the risk reduction that JPL and NASA has to operate under. Jim Cameron and his team, Jim and Ron Allen, one of the key engineers, they have been working on this for a number of years, but it was really November of 2011 when everything got the green light and turned on to build this submersible. And so to go from November to March and have a submersible that can, you know, go down 11 kilometers and not kill somebody, that's an astonishing feat. So it was really, I give a lot of credit to Jim and Ron Allum and the rest of the team for pulling that together. You know, that's a really remarkable achievement.
Just to finish off then, I want to talk a little bit about what's going on now here at JPL as we speak. We've just been over into, I've been in mission control at JPL, listeners, just now, and you just mentioned the Mars rover, which is basically on its way now. It's on its way there. So tell us when that's going to get there so listeners can look out for what's going to actually happen.
So August 5th, and it's, goodness, 10:30 p.m. I forget if that's Pacific or Eastern time, but you guys, Europeans, just look it up. But August 5th in the U.S. at night. And that is going to be an exciting night. The Curiosity rover is the biggest, most complex, and most scientifically capable rover ever built and sent off to Mars, or for that matter, to any world. And it's going to such an exciting place. It's going to a region called Gale Crater. And Gale Crater is kind of positioned on what you would consider to be the sort of shores of Mars's ancient ocean. And part of the attraction of going to Gale is that my colleagues who study the geology of Mars specifically argue that the stratigraphy, the various layers on the rocks that you see there, hold a record of the sort of ancient ocean, ancient shorelines, and ancient sediments on Mars. And of course, on Earth, you go to ancient ocean sediments, and that's where you find evidence of past life, possibly even fossils. Now, are we going to find fossils on Mars? Who knows, right? That would be the Holy Grail. But the rover is capable of connecting the chemistry of Mars to past habitability. And so that mission will land on August 5th. You saw in Mission Control today what's called an operational readiness test, where the entry, descent, and landing engineers are going through all sorts of scenarios of what if this happens, what if that happens, what do we do, what commands do we send? They're trying to break it, exactly. And what's great is, like, there's one of the key Mars engineers is designated as sort of the bad guy, and his job and his team is to try and stump the team that's trying to get the lander onto the surface. And so that's going on right now. And then we brought you up to the Mars yard and out to the testbed facility. And there again, the engineering teams are going through all sorts of possible scenarios. And these things are scary, right? Who knows? Any number of random events that's happening on Mars, or there's always the possibility of single point failure, and there's always things that you can't predict.
And it happens. Beagle 2.
Exactly. You know, and so I always get frustrated when things fail and people come, you know, pounding on, well, how could you let this happen? Well, we don't do these things because they're easy, and we do them because they're hard, to paraphrase Kennedy. And, you know, for goodness sake, it's called exploration and discovery for a reason. So I get very passionate about the need to push the frontier, the need to allow failure, and to adopt a certain risk posture. And there again, that comes back to sort of the what was happening with the exploration of the ocean with Jim Cameron. With him doing his own private expedition, he's allowed to adopt whatever risk posture he wants. And he adopted he's very safe and you know, he knows the ins and outs of the thing, but he doesn't have to be answerable to the taxpayer, say. And so at the end of the day, at NASA, at JPL, the missions that go forth have to be answerable to the taxpayer. But what I find is the taxpayers want us to be bold. They want us to get cool things done. They want us to send that lander to Europa. They want us to, you know, just send humans off to Mars. They want NASA. They want JPL. They want us to push the frontier and be bold and to get great things done.
That's a perfect point for us to end. So I've been talking to Kevin Han. Kevin, thank you very much for spending the time to talk to Little Atoms today.
My pleasure, Neil. Time for a pint?
Most definitely.
Hi, I'm Seth Shostak. That was a Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. The show was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was made possible by a traveling fellowship from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. Follow the trip on Twitter @LittleAtoms, and thanks for listening.